Hello and welcome. I'm Mark Gagan from The Voice of Insurance, and I'm your host today. Today's podcast is on a subject that is going to be front of mind for many UK liability insurers, because it's about the potential for sports head injuries developing into a new source of casualty claims. Hardly a week goes by without high-profile stories being reported in the media around a potential causal link between head injuries sustained while playing contact sports and devastating illnesses such as dementia. The results of studies are eagerly awaited and reported in depth. Meanwhile, plaintiff lawyers are clearly beginning to prepare for a battle ahead. And as we all know, rugby and football are hugely popular participation sports for very large numbers of amateurs, as well as supporting highly successful and lucrative professional leagues in which thousands of players make their living. So what is the potential for this developing into mass tort and a potential major new liability exposure on our hands? What are the arguments likely to be around duty of care and causation? And what are the legal angles of attack and defence likely to centre around? And which classes of business are going to be affected? And how might policies respond? The issues are highly complex, which is why I'm delighted I was able to catch up with Steve Bellingham, Head of Strategy, Disease and Illness at Pro Insurance Solutions. In our interview, Steve gives us the benefit of his long professional experience handling similar claims. Listen on for a detailed appraisal of where we currently stand in the UK, as well as clear advice on what potential defendants, their brokers and insurers should be doing now to be the best prepared for what we all suspect may be just around the corner. Steve is a great expert and a strong communicator, and I think this interview is a really useful briefing. Enjoy the podcast. Right, Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It seems that potential liabilities due to sports-related head injuries seem to be going higher and higher up the news agenda, and we're hearing more and more about it. Can you outline the current situation on where we are?
Yeah, certainly. Probably worthwhile just having a quick look at some history and saying that the sports sector has always produced liability claims. But what we're seeing now and what the media is reporting is potentially a new tranche and a different type of claim that will carry with it its own specific complications and issues. Throughout recent history, we've seen claims in the sports sector. I mean, the high-profile ones of Ben Collett, the Man United player, who obtained substantial damages for a player-on-player incident back in the mid-2000s. We've had all of the claims that came from the Hillsborough disaster and the fire at Bradford City Stadium. Those claims and others might be considered typical sort of claims that such sporting risk would be likely to produce, and certainly the sorts of risks that would have been in the contemplation of underwriters when they wrote the policies. We've also seen a large volume of sexual abuse allegations stemming from both amateur and professional football. The US have seen the similar in gymnastics, elite gymnastics. And we've seen some notable head injury claims in the past, notably Michael Watson, when he sued the British Boxing Board of Control after his injury suffered in his fight against Chris Eubank. Those might be categorised as sort of typical claims or one-off incidents that are seen across most liability portfolios, so not unique necessarily to sport. What we're concerned with here, what the media reporting has been highlighting and what we've seen in the way of instigations of claims, are cases involving allegations of onset of neurological conditions, early onset dementia, a condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which we call CTE, these being allegedly resultant from repeating events over a period of time, be they head injury, head impacts, concussive, or even subconcussive events. So this is new, and at the moment is specifically active in rugby, but obviously has the potential to expand into other sports.
And that would be things like football from heading heavy balls.
Again, the media has been quite active in highlighting incidents of ex-players who are suffering from dementia, for which there may be a suggestion of a relationship between that and the sport that they played at professional level.
Rugby and football are both mass participation sports, as well as being very popular professional sports in the UK, probably the two most popular professional sports in the UK. Where are we at the moment in terms of claims coming through, and have there been any cases or judgments yet?
We're in the early stages, regardless of which sport you might select. In relation to football and the potential for long-term impact of heading the ball, I'm not aware of any active claims at this time, but that could change quite quickly, certainly. If you read the media reports, you could form a view that such cases are probable, potentially inevitable. But in relation to active claims, they are in the UK, at least, limited to rugby at this point.
And in terms of who is likely to be the defendant, is it going to be the sports governing bodies, like the RFU, for example, or the FA, or is it likely to be the clubs themselves, if they're professional clubs, or indeed amateur clubs, that are going to be vulnerable here?
It's a good question. The short answer would be it remains to be seen. I am aware of letters of claim that have been issued and received by the rugby union governing bodies. So at least at this moment, it is clear that the governing bodies are being targeted. That is not to say that individual clubs may not be targeted in the future. Individual clubs have received claims in the past, but they have related to what I was mentioning previously, which was one-off incidents, perhaps the incidence of a head injury in a particular game and allegations as to what the on-site medical professional did or didn't do in order to protect that player in the immediate aftermath, which was essentially large parts of the Michael Watson case. In relation to these cumulative events, where it may not even be possible to actually identify exactly which events are the subject of the case, those claims are being directed against the governing bodies at this moment in time, and possibly for good reason.
And what about differing duties of care between different sports? It seems fairly obvious that boxing, say, would have a very different duty of care. Obviously, boxing, part of the game is to hit people in the head. That's how you win, as opposed to rugby, and then as opposed to contact sports that have a lower level of contact, like, for example, football.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. If you're looking to answer the question, what level of duty of care did a particular governing body or club have to the claimant? There's probably a direct correlation between the level of the duty of care owed and the level of risk. So we would all place boxing at the top, and we would say that the risks of injuries of this type in boxing are obvious and manifest. Therefore, the duties of care owned by those controlling those boxing matches, etc., is suitably heightened. In relation to rugby, I think the governing bodies in rugby will readily accept that rugby as a sport creates some increased risks over and above others. And therefore, I'm sure those governing bodies also accept that their duty of care is heightened above some other sports. I think they would also like to say that they've been at the forefront of research and development in this area and the issuing of appropriate guidance.
And we're going to go into a lot more detail into those potential legalistic arguments that are going to be used. But before we do that, what sort of lines of business are going to be, now we're relating this back to insurance, what sort of lines of business are going to be more likely to receive claims? Because obviously we seem to have exposure here for employers' liability, particularly with professional clubs, or indeed the public liability.
Absolutely. EL and PL will be the policies that are likely to be triggered. And so they are the policies that people should be looking to locate if they believe themselves to be a potential defendant. Which ones are triggered, or in certain circumstances, whether both are triggered in the same claim, is largely dictated by whether the claimant chooses to pursue their employer club or the governing body, or as I've mentioned, potentially both. Rugby in the UK was not professional until the mid-1990s. We're talking about cumulative effects of career incidents, then you could see a scenario where at least some of the alleged causative incidents predated professionalism and therefore will not trigger EL policies. In the main, you can probably say if claimants choose to sue their clubs, it will likely to be due to an employment relationship. Otherwise, the claims will be public liability. And in relation to the governing bodies, unless we see a scenario in which those governing bodies directly contracted with players, perhaps for international duty or something like that, those will be public liability claims.
So going into detail now, looking at potential claims when they get into the real nitty-gritty, what are the legal lines of attack that plaintiffs are likely to be looking at here?
Well, as we said, the claims are at a very early stage at the moment, and there are certainly no rulings to rely upon. Also, probably worth pointing out that the letter of claim that has been issued is the sort of opening instigation and doesn't necessarily bear relevance to what may be pleaded should these cases enter litigation. So we are inevitably going to be quite speculative about what allegations will be run and what allegations claimants might see as being most viable to them.
I suppose, Steve, if you were the plaintiff, what would you be planning?
If my claim was against the governing body, who are obviously responsible for research and development, providing guidance and instructions to club protocols that they may be able to either recommend or force clubs to adhere to, or at least attempt to force clubs to adhere to, I think I would be looking at the questions of what might be done to either prevent or minimize the incidence of head injury impact, and thereafter, what protocols and medical checks may have been appropriate after the head injury had been sustained. So if you look at rugby as a sport, it's impossible to eradicate the potential for head impacts in any way, but you may, and we've seen this in the National Football League in America, you may be able to limit the amount or the risk of such impacts in training environments where the process is more easily controlled than in an active game. So if I was a claimant lawyer, I might be looking at suggesting that the repetition was too great and should have been minimized as far as was reasonably practical. And or I might argue that the protocols and medical checks after such injuries had been sustained may have been stricter and more appropriate. So to what tests does an individual need to pass in order to be deemed appropriate to return to the game, be it this game or the next game in 2, 3, 4 weeks' time? We now see a number of concussion protocols in place. Should they have been in place earlier? Should they have been more stringent, et cetera, et cetera? And also, you may even go as far as central records, a suggestion that governing bodies should have been responsible for keeping central records of player injury history. Because, of course, if players move between clubs or if players play for multiple clubs at the same time, are those clubs in a position to know the history of that player or what events he may have suffered in the past? So there could be some avenues there, potentially, but perhaps with some difficulties from the claimant perspective. We might also talk about head and neck protection in sport, especially in training, etc. Very big question marks as to the extent to which that actually protects the player, or has been the allegation in American football, actually provides the player with an illusion of protection that then causes him to be more aggressive more than that might otherwise be the case.
So I can imagine from this that the defences are going to be very similar around demonstrating that there have been robust protocols around the sort of thing that you see in head injury protocols in rugby, the sort of standing count or having people off being assessed while the game goes on before they're allowed back on the field, that kind of thing. Are those likely to be the main defences?
Yes, I mean, the defences are numerous and will be quite complicated. But if we were to look at them at a high level now, it will centre around what was known, what should have been known. And in this respect, I'm talking about the cumulative effects of a number of what may have been quite minor injuries. Was the evidence available? Should governing bodies or clubs have been aware of evidence that this presented a material risk to the point that they were driven by their duties of care to make some protections against that? And if so, what were those protections? Were they reasonable? They can't be too onerous, because otherwise you essentially cease the ability to play the sport. So were any precautions and protections that brought in place reasonable due to the perceived risks, et cetera, et cetera? Ignoring the question of causation, which would be, well, okay, even if greater protections could have been brought in place, would have they really altered the outcome?
And in terms of causation, obviously the body of evidence, that there's huge scientific interest in this now and a lot more studies happening. I mean, they're out in the papers almost every couple of weeks, we see something. How is that body of evidence building up around causation? Could it be a sort of super defense to say, well, we haven't proven that there's causation yet to insurers?
It's a complex subject. There is the question of medical causation, which is what can we say about the risks and the likely connections between certain events and the potential for these dementia-type symptoms, accepting that dementia has a myriad of causes, some of which we know and some of which we most certainly don't know. So there is that side, and then there is the legal test as to what a claimant will need to prove in order to satisfy a court of an entitlement to damages as a result of proving a causative link between the activities and the condition he now suffers from. I think it's probably also important to point out that we're seeing a lot of studies now producing evidence, and that may well drive precautions or the need for the governing bodies to reconsider their guidance and their protocols and precautions that they might seek to enforce into the future. But what was known in 2000, what was known in 1995, what was known in 1980 will again be important to claims being brought now relating to historic events.
So it's that history of medical knowledge is going to be key to say, well, we couldn't possibly have known at the time, given that no one ever studied links between head injuries and dementia and other things.
Yes, absolutely. And even if there were such studies, did those studies produce results that the defendant should have been aware of? and should have been able to make links between this study and that which they could control, so as to bring in the sorts of protocols that we're talking over and above those that they did have in place.
And again, with this phenomenon, do you think there's a possibility for aggregation of claims, or do you think they're going to be a whole slew of individual claims, or could there be sort of class actions?
Definitely the letter of claim that had been received by the governing bodies makes specific reference to what in the UK we would call a group litigation order.
Yeah.
In the States, they would call a class action.
Yeah.
That seems reasonable in my view. I mean, the purpose of a group litigation order is to manage those issues that are generic to all claimants in one place.
So things like causation, medical argument, there's no point having that argument 1,000 times.
Yes, exactly the point, to establish duties of care, generic duties of care, generic dates of knowledge, what the causation test will be at law, what hurdle do the claimants need to get over in order to secure a right to damages. So, of course, you only consider causation once you've considered the ideas of duty of care and breach of duty. You only get to causation if you get that far. But what will be the legal test? And there is some differing case law relating to differing disease and injury types on that. Where does this one sit? What would be the appropriate test for them? But once the generic issues are sorted and you have the framework, the legal framework, you then have the ability to test individual claims against that framework. And you can easily see a scenario where some claimants may succeed in their actions applying those generic tests and some may not. But as we said previously, we're at an early stage here. And as far as I'm aware, no formal application has been made to court for GLO status at this point.
Is it right to assume that another potential problem might be, obviously, professional players move around, they change clubs quite regularly. The issue of apportionment, if there are different policies in play at different clubs, on the EL side, for example, might that be a problem? The sort of problem that we've seen with asbestosis of people working at different engineering firms, for example, over their career.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And that is possibly a reason why I can understand why the initial letters of claim have been issued against governing bodies, because to some extent that simplifies the process for claimants. If a claimant paid for 5 or 6 different clubs, he may find it difficult to prove causation against an individual club, dependent upon what causation test the courts decide is to be applied. But of course, that gets a whole lot more simple if all of those clubs fell under the auspices of one governing body. So this might be why we see governing bodies being targeted in the first instance, because it does simplify matters to some extent for claimants.
One other thing, in terms of when insurers and defendants are preparing themselves and their brokers are preparing themselves for this potential wave of claims that could be coming, what sort of plaintiff are we dealing with here? We've seen lots of very well-funded plaintiffs and very well-organized plaintiffs in other spheres. Is it likely to be the same sort of phenomenon where someone's really gone out and got funding and is ready to push this all the way to the Supreme Court?
I think it's likely. These cases raise the sort of issues that could easily end up in the Supreme Court, in part or in whole. I can see there are a number of issues here. I can see 1 or 2 at least that may require Supreme Court consideration. All of these claims will be covered by one-way cost quacks. So in that respect, each claimant has a protection in that if their claim fails, they will not be liable for the defendant's costs. So it gives claimants and claimant lawyers some freedom to pursue claims that may be classed as perhaps more speculative than others. They have that protection that they don't need to protect themselves against an adverse costs order. But even then, these claims are not going to be cheap to prosecute from a claimant's perspective. I think that's why, although we see quite a lot of claimant lawyers who are advertising for clients, it would seem that one legal firm at the moment has been quicker off the mark in that respect and has managed to secure a volume of claimants so to make the investment that they might put into prosecuting these claims more viable for them. Because of quacks, defendants can't ask much in the way of questions concerning how the claimant is funding their claim, but there will need to be some outlay on the part of claimant lawyers in order to pursue these claims in a complete way and through the various courts as may be necessary. So whether they have secured their own funding for that, or whether they see this as something that they are prepared to fund themselves due to the profits available on the other side, should they be successful, is one for them to consider.
But it does sound like it's a reasonably favourable environment for plaintiffs, and it sounds like that some of them are going to be well funded.
I think that's right. I form the view that if claimant lawyers hadn't already established a business model and a cost-benefit analysis for themselves, then they wouldn't have issued them. I mean, the claims are there now. They're live. I can't see them simply being abandoned anytime soon. So you have to assume that whether they've got their numbers right or wrong, that claimant lawyers are satisfied themselves that the potential benefits outweigh the financial risks.
You mentioned before about North America, the United States in particular, always seems to be a decade ahead of everybody else. When we've had similar sort of sounding cases, particularly in American football, because they're so further advanced and we've seen some settlements, some very high profile cases, have we got anything we can learn from that to prepare ourselves for what might be happening here?
Everybody looks to the US. I mean, talking wider of head injury in sport, if anyone's looking for emerging risks, et cetera, then people tend to look to the US, and I do myself at times. I think that's fine to do so. But I think it's wrong to draw a direct parallel between what happens in the US and what might happen in the UK. There have been plenty of cases that have been brought successfully in the US that have never seen their way into the UK, mainly because we operate a very different judicial system. In the US, you have effectively jury trials for a lot of these things. They're perhaps not the best method of dealing with complicated issues such as this. You also have the application of punitive damages, where the amount that a claimant might receive is based on the perceived wrongdoing of the defendant, as opposed to in the UK, which is the sum of the losses they've sustained, which is why you see quite extravagant sums being quoted out of the US that you don't see in the UK. So often I prefer to look to Australia to see what parallels can be drawn then on the basis that they operate a very similar judicial system based upon originally the UK system. So if we go back to the US, we've seen that the NFL have settled with the players' union in relation to claims of this ilk. Difficult to see how that sort of a settlement could be repeated in the UK, because it seems to relate to an amount of money being handed over by the NFL owners to the players' union, who will then allocate that money to its members, both current and future, in a way that they see fit. Difficult to see how you could achieve that in the UK in relation to our judicial system. Also, I do wonder whether that settlement was as much driven by commercial considerations as it was legal liability ones.
Yeah.
The NFL is a closed shop, no promotion or relegation. All of the owners agree to be bound by wage control, et cetera, et cetera. They negotiate regularly with the players' union over benefits and payments, et cetera, et cetera. The whole sport is mutually beneficial both to the players and to the owners. So it's important to them that the game continues and there's not disputes and strikes, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that my understanding is that the settlement was achieved prior to the discovery stage, which in America you start interviewing witnesses and when you start disclosing documents to each other, et cetera. The fact that it settled so early makes me feel that it was commercially expedient to both sides to end the issue and move forwards.
And you mentioned about Australia. So is there any learnings from Australia?
I've made a couple of calls to some contacts in Australia, and I think it can probably be best summed up as they're in a similar but possibly less developed position to ourselves. So obviously Australia plays a lot of rugby union, rugby league, Australian rules, which is similar again in its context, perhaps slightly less a risk due to the method in which the game is played. There have been some claims brought in Australia. They were individual claims as opposed to group actions. They were brought against the clubs as opposed to the governing bodies. And they have discontinued. That's not easy to understand whether they have discontinued because the claimant has abandoned the case or they have discontinued because the clubs have settled. But certainly they also looked distinct from what we're talking about now, as they appear to relate to one-off incidents, one-off injuries and the immediate aftermath. The sorts of claims that we have seen in the UK, some English-based professional rugby clubs have seen and settled claims relating to specific incidents on a specific day in a specific match. So I'm not aware that Australia is currently seeing active claims relating to these cumulative effect type allegations.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we've got all the listeners' attention now in terms of running through their books to see if how much sports liability exposure they might have. But in a practical sense, what can insurers, brokers, potential defendants be doing right now to make sure that they're as best prepared as they possibly can be for any future possible claims?
Yes, it's a good question. It's difficult to provide specific guidance when the case is at such an early stage. If I was a broker or a rugby club who employed players, or if I was a broker as such, I would be looking to satisfy myself that I have a full understanding of my insurance history, both employer's liability and public liability, going back certainly into the 1990s and potentially a little bit earlier than that. Not easy to identify policies from that sort of long ago, especially in the public liability environment, where I think it's generally accepted that records were not kept in the same manner as employer's liability. But they need to be identifying their covers, where their gaps might be. They need to be searching to fill those gaps where at all possible. They should certainly be looking to notify those insurers they have identified as soon as possible, even if they haven't received any claims, simply so as to protect themselves against any potential late notification issues that may be sitting in the policy wordings.
Yep.
From an insurer point of view, they're going to do the same thing in reverse. They need to understand what their potential exposure is. And certainly also from an insurance point of view, they should be looking to potentially retain experts. It appears there's going to be a lot of claimants out there and a lot of potential defendants and a lot of insurance policies at risk of being triggered. And you need to ensure that you have secured the best experts that you feel you might need for fear that somebody else may secure that expert, then be conflicted from working for you.
Right. So that's a very important thing. Make sure you get your expert on your side before the plaintiff does.
I mean, I have a personal experience where we got active in that area to find that a couple of experts had already been approached and had given undertakings. So it's not easy, but you need to have more than one option and you need to secure the best option you feel you can.
And in terms of those policies, are they likely to be losses occurring during policies that those clubs will have bought, or are they going to be claims made?
Yeah, interesting that. Employers' liability policies will be overwhelmingly injury caused. Hence the need to go back into the 90s and potentially the 80s, because the allegation will be that the injury was caused by the impact injury during the game, even if the player is now in his 50s and hasn't played for some time. And there's plenty of case law to confirm that that is how employers' liability policies will trigger.
Yep.
Public liability policies, especially the public liabilities that we might be talking about that predate the mid-2000s, are very likely to have been issued on an injury occurring or an injury happening basis. The two words are essentially interchangeable. They mean the same thing. But it does raise issues as to when did the injury occur? When did the injury happen? We have this issue in mesothelioma,
yep,
which is slightly different in the fact that obviously there is the inhalation of the fibers many decades ago, but no development of those fibers into a tumour until decades later. So clearly the injury didn't occur or happen at the point of inhalation. But when did it occur? Did it occur at the point of manifestation of symptoms? Probably not. Did it occur sometime in the process of that tumour growing? Yes. In this instance, it's an issue that may potentially cause some dispute. My personal view is that it is likely that the injury will be deemed to have happened at the point that the event occurred. So there is an impact incident which causes an injury, be it minor or be it a concussion, et cetera, and then the dementia that may only manifest itself sometimes later is simply a progression of that original index injury. So my personal feeling is that EL and PL policies will effectively trigger in the same way, and they will be the policies that were enforced at the time of the impact incident. But that's not to say that there aren't some weird and wonderful wordings out there, or some arguments that some carriers may take because they believe them to be correct and advantageous to do so.
So again, it sounds like a lot more issues there, and obviously locate those wordings as soon as possible and get the legal advice.
I think that's right. I mean, I think notify your insurers so that you are protecting yourself against the small risk that the policy might contain some words which come back to hurt you later on. And enter into a dialogue and ask these questions and ask the insurer to opine as to how they believe that policies may or may not trigger.
Thanks so much, Steve. We've run through a huge amount of detail. Just want to ask you more of a gut feeling thing based on your professional experience and very long professional experience and expert knowledge. What's your gut feeling when you're looking at this potential problem? Is it something that fills you with a lot of dread and you think there's going to be a lot of blood spilt in the market over this, do you think?
That's a big question, to be frank with you. It's a material risk. It has to be a material risk. And people should be looking at their coverage exposure and trying to form views as to how involved they think they might be in this. Unlikely that any particular carrier has specific provision for this. whether they have other provision that they can direct to it, or whether they need to set separate provision now, whether they had a sort of catch-all provision for the unknown remains to be seen. Each will need to consider their own previous decisions in that regard. But these claims are going to be complex. There are a lot of issues involved. I would not underestimate the difficulties that claimants face in bringing successful actions. I think that there are numerous defences that could prove and should prove successful, but they may not be complete defences, as in they may provide a defence to either a governing body or a club for allegations of events in the early 1990s, but then you could get to a point by which knowledge and available information was such that other actions or greater actions would be required. So it's difficult to say, will these claims succeed or will these claims fail? I think ultimately some will and a lot won't, but we're going to have to play through with this. When we talk about liability, this is an interesting comment that I just want to highlight to people to give the idea as to the sorts of balancing acts that the court will need to apply. And it sits within the Compensation Act 2006, which is essentially a statement of principles. But Section 1 there, people can go and read it for themselves, it recognises a desire, a societal desire, for want of a better term, not to rule in ways that prevents recreational activities that have wider benefits, either to the participants or to the population in general. It's a recognition of the greater good of some of these activities and the fact that none of them come without risk. And it simply advises the court, in fact, I'll read the first line. It says, a court considering a claim in negligence or breach of duty, which these claims will be, in determining whether a defendant should have taken particular steps to meet a standard of care, have regard to whether the requirement to take steps might prevent a desirable activity from being undertaken at all, or to a particular extent or in a particular way. I think that very adequately sums up the issue that courts will have and why in this country we don't see huge volumes of successful claims for amateur football tackles that create injury, golfers hitting stray golf balls and hitting innocent members. The point is, this is what society does. It is recreation. It is generally desirable. And therefore, there is going to be a standard that the claimants are going to have to get over before the courts are going to be making governing bodies and clubs involved in those desirable activities liable for the consequences.
And Stephen, what sort of time frame are we looking at, do you think? How long is it going to take for all this to work its way through?
Some time, I think, is the answer to that. I think it's extremely unlikely that all issues will be determined finally by first instance courts. I think there will be areas that will go to appeal. They may be numerous, they may be singular, but there will be areas that will go to appeal and potentially appeal again after that. To a large extent, it will be dictated by the quality of the evidence that is out there. And I think that's still being collected and reviewed and the impact of it being considered. But I think it's unlikely that there's any sort of silver bullet that will arise that will make defendants believe they don't have meaningful defences to these claims. Whether that results in claims being compromised in some way or whether we end up at trial, my gut feeling is the latter, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Steve, thank you so much for your time and thanks for going into so much detail on this really interesting and complex subject and a live subject. So I think it's going to be vexing us and troubling us and worrying us for many, many years to come. But thank you so much for setting the scene here. I think it shows a huge amount of value and I think it'll be very, very useful for the listeners. Thank you so much.
That's not a problem. I suspect we may be talking about this again at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks, Jenna.
The issues are highly complex, which is why I'm delighted I was able to catch up with Steve Bellingham, Head of Strategy, Disease and Illness at Pro Insurance Solutions.